I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Years ago, I had a job at a community mental health center in Philadelphia checking on adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities who had been institutionalized at Pennhurst, at Byberry, Sealands Grove, Hamburg, Embryville, and other facilities in Pennsylvania. It was a sobering, depressing, and sometimes frightening experience seeing people who had been warehoused and largely forgotten. Then came deinstitutionalization, a movement to provide treatment, housing, employment, and social services for these adults in local communities, believing this was a more humane approach. Ronnie Polonesky's series in the Philadelphia Daily News this week and Philadelphia Inquirer this week, Falling Off the Cliff, details the difficulties that adults with these disabilities and their aging parents face today as they deal with long waiting lists for services, poorly trained and poorly paid and sometimes uncaring staff, money problems, and a confusing bureaucracy. And just to add to the parental stress, the thought of what will happen to their children after they die. I should also add, this is a story of resilience, determination, and abiding love. Let me introduce our three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia series. Excuse me, in our Philadelphia studio is Ronnie Polonesky, the author of this series. She's Metro columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, Philadelphia Daily News. And Ronnie, congratulations. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Audrey Cochia, and she and our other guest, Maureen Devaney, are co-founders and co-executive directors of Vision for Equality, founded back in 1996. And Audrey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And also, Maureen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Ronnie, let me begin with you. And just, again, on a personal note, I had a niece who had cerebral palsy, a pretty severe case of cerebral palsy. And against all odds, she lived into her 40s and died a couple of years ago. This is a very personal story, I think, for a lot of people and affects families in unique ways, caregivers, and even these adults in a kind of unique way. What got you into this whole world?
A few years ago, in 2013, I heard that a intellectually disabled young woman named Christina Sankey, she was 37 years old, had gone missing. And, you know, you work in a newsroom, you know that we get these alerts all the time from the police. Someone has gone missing, someone vulnerable, usually means that they have a disability or they're young or they have Alzheimer's or something. And then usually within a day or so, you get an alert saying that they've been located and they're fine. So this alert comes over about Christina Sankey, and I made note of it. And then the next morning, an alert came over and said that she had been found dead the next morning, frozen to death.
Wow.
And I wondered about it because it said that she had been vulnerable, so I wondered, did she have a state-paid caregiver? And then I found out that she did, and I thought, well, I think there's going to be a big ruckus now, because I was remembering just a year or two before, in Bucks County, a school called the Wood School, where a lot of people with intellectual disabilities live there. It's a residential facility. A young man had been left in a van on a really hot day, and he suffocated and died. And there was an immediate big investigation. His parents, who lived out of state, brought all the force that they could on this. There was a trial, and I don't want to get this wrong, but the woman who they found to be at fault for this, I think she got a 2-year sentence.
Wow.
So I just presume that something similar might happen with Christina, but nothing happened at all. And to make a long story short, it was being dismissed as just something very tragic. She was prone to wandering. What could you expect? And everyone seemed to be dismissing her. And I thought if she had been an equally vulnerable toddler, the whole city would have been up in arms. So I tracked down her mother, and her mother was furious. She said, no one cares because we're poor, we're of color, we have no money. And that just kind of began the whole thing. And I ended up writing a story called The Death No One Cares About. And we wrote about Christina. And as a result of that, the DA's office did a grand jury investigation. And the young woman who was in charge of Christina's care pled guilty to, I think, a count of felony count of misdemeanor neglect. But as a result of that, so many parents called, and they had all of these stories, and they're saying, you don't know the half of it. And I just began to look at stories, and I was speaking with Maureen and with Dee, and the more I learned, the more I thought, you know, it's like pulling a thread on a sweater, and I didn't know how much further this thing was going to go.
Well, let me get both Audrey and Maureen in on the conversation. Audrey, tell us about your daughter, Gina.
Well, Gina's 52, and she lives at home with her father and I. She has significant disabilities. We care for her, take care of most of her needs every day. She goes to a program called SPIN, Special People in the Northeast, where she spends most of her time in community. She has a lot of medical issues, so she has someone who spends most of their time with her. She's insulin dependent, and but she's out there. She volunteers at several locations. She's always looking for a little job if she can find it, and everybody knows her in our community, which is important to us in case someday we're not here. If people, if they don't see her around, or if she doesn't look quite up to par, or someone's doing something they don't think is right, people are going to get to somebody and let them know. I feel like we're building a protection around her, yet giving her all the freedom and liberty that she wants and loves.
Well, I want to pick up on that. Maureen, tell us about your daughter, Colleen.
Yeah, Colleen is 47 years old. She lives at home also with my husband and I, Tom. And she is very happy at home. And we're happy that she is happy and that she, you know, can stay with us. We do. Colleen receives supports through SPIN, also Special People in Northeast, and also supportive behavioral resources. So sometimes on the weekend, you know, someone will take her out too, to, you know, to have so she can have a social life and, you know, and do some things. During the week, she's really happy too. She has a couple volunteer jobs, and she just got another job where she'll be paid. So she's really excited, I think, about that. And she also requires one-on-one care all the time. She cannot be alone. She has a lot of, you know, autism, and including intellectual disabilities. So, you know, it just makes her life better when someone's with her, you know, at arm's reach. And she has, you know, good people that really work with her every day.
Vision for Equality, which the two of you founded in 1996, or almost 20 years ago, was that based on your own inabilities or difficulties navigating the system? You figure, well, if this has got to be tough for me, and I guess I'm looking at you, Audrey, if this is tough for me, then it's got to be tough for other people as well.
Yeah, I mean, I really started way back for Gina because she was about 11 and a half or 12 before she got into school. And that was only after a lawsuit was filed against the state of Pennsylvania, against Schapp.
Governor Schapp.
Governor Schapp. Wow. And she was 11 and a half before she even went into school. So we knew what it was like to wait. And when she finally reached 21 and then into 22 and 23 and she no longer had any kind of opportunity, we really felt the pain of what, you know, what it's like to have no hope. I would knock on doors of providers and offer them money if they would help us. She certainly wanted something to do with her life every day. Otherwise, she was very, you know, she would really be trying at times. So finally, through another lawsuit, through Judge Broderick, actually, who was the original Pennhurst judge, who I loved dearly.
Close Pennhurst, yeah, made the decision.
And so she ended up getting in through a technicality. And I, you know, the day she ran down the steps and onto that bus for the first time, I promised my God I would never forget what it felt like, and I would work from that day forward for others so that they didn't have to have that same pain.
Same for you, Maureen?
Yes, yeah. You know, when Colleen was young, I became very involved with, you know, learning about intellectual disabilities because we really didn't know anything at all. So she was only 3 or 4 when I started getting involved and, you know, taught myself everything that I knew. I went to every course, anything I could do to learn about it, not just for Colleen, but for other people. Because when I started learning about her, then I learned other people had similar issues. And it was really good because, you know, today we still have a support network of a few of our families that I met when she was in preschool.
Oh, wow.
So, and I think that's really good. And we're still very good friends. And that's carried us through our lives. And I think, so then I worked for Parents Union for Public Schools. I worked for the Philadelphia Police and Fire Association for people with intellectual and other disabilities. And then I worked for the Arc of Philadelphia. So I kind of, you know, and then besides that, I did a lot of volunteer work, which I think is really important. Most of our families, if they're into this, you know. But when Colleen was around 13 years old, I started worrying about what was going to happen to her after 21, because I started seeing some of my friends not have services for their children. So that really inspired me to get involved with transition stuff with the state. And, you know, still it took all those years. And still when she got out of school, she had nothing, you know. And it took us, and then we went to OVR, and then it took us a little while. And then, you know, by the end of that first year, she did get something.
Well, Yeah, Ronnie, let me just go back to you because your series is called Falling Off the Cliff, and this is what happens at age 21 for these young people. They become adults, and they essentially age out, I guess, of the school system. And then the question is, so what happens next?
Right. There's an entitlement. And I think the first thing I want to say, just listening to Maureen and to Dee, is that you know, parents are their kids' first and most fierce advocates. And what is just was so moving to me is that once they get what they need for their kids, they can't keep it to themselves. And you've had to sort of bond, and there are these parent groups because there hasn't been a system that actually works for you, and you've made it work for you in the best way you can. But just wanted to say that. So Falling Off the Cliff, there's an education entitlement which parents push for, which didn't happen before.
You're entitled to go to school.
You're entitled to
like
go to
every
school.
Other student.
Exactly,
or
until the age of 21 and get an appropriate education in as close to a community setting as possible.
That wasn't until 1976.
Right, which is still recent, right? Mm-hmm. So what that does is it gives families a place for their child to be every day. A family has structure. You can't run your family without structure. But after age 21, the entitlement goes away. And then after that, you would be entitled, if you wanted, to have your child put into an institution because there's also an entitlement to institutional care. But families said...
This is the waiver, right?
Right, right. So you're entitled to that. But if you don't want that, you can waive your right to that and instead have services provided in the community. But the waiting list for that, as these ladies will tell you, is right now 13,700 and something people are waiting to get services in that way.
Well, let me just underscore what you just said. Yeah. So that if I had a child with intellectual and developmental disabilities and I actually wanted them to go to an institution, mm-hmm. that would happen. And that would be paid for?
Yeah, it would happen and be paid for. Now, I'm not so sure about if there's enough spots these days because a lot of institutions have been closed. However, right. That's an entitlement. Yes.
But if I wanted to keep my child at home, there's a wait list?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's more expensive to be institutionalized. I think in Pennsylvania, close to 3 to 5 times more expensive.
Right.
So there's a waiting list for the cheaper option, which makes no sense.
Right. And we talk to the legislators a lot. That's one of the things that Vision for Equality does. We spend a lot of time up on the Hill trying to educate legislators about how to spend their money. Why would you want to spend $450,000 for somebody to live in a segregated, isolated setting when in reality they could either at home get anywhere from $25,000 maybe up to $60,000 depending on the people's needs,
sure,
be met in the community or even in a residential setting where it's maybe about $120,000, $130,000. So we continually try to educate them about the fact that where to spend their money and spend it wisely.
Yeah, hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break. Talking with Audrey Cochia, Maureen Devaney, they are co-executive directors and co-founders of Vision for Equality Incorporated. Also with us, Ronnie Polonesky. We're talking about a series that she had in the Philadelphia Daily News, Philadelphia Inquirer, called Falling Off the Cliff. And it's about people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their parents. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're talking about Ronnie Polonesky's four-part series in the Philadelphia Daily News, Philadelphia Inquirer, called Falling Off the Cliff. It's a moving, deeply personal story about adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities and the challenges they and their aging parents face when it comes to things like safety and housing, work, and quality of life. Also with us, Audrey Cochia and Maureen Devaney. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Maureen, before you speak, let me just read a comment from Steve. Greetings, Dee and Maureen, from Steve Davis at PersonLink. Vision does amazing work, great show, much needed discussion.
Thank you.
Wanted to say something right before the break.
Yes. Yeah. As you said earlier, Vision for Equality conducts the Pennsylvania waiting list campaign. And we have wonderful volunteers across the state that go up to Harrisburg and really do a wonderful job educating the legislators. And Dee and I also go up and meet with them. So it's not just Philadelphia. we do this across the state. There's over 13,000 people waiting, and about 6,000 of them are in critical situations where they need services today. They're, you know, maybe
nine. So what do you do?
We have 90-year-old moms taking care of 70-year-old sons and daughters. We just go and say, you know, here's the need. Last year, the governor did see, you know, the need, and he did, you know, there was a great initiative this year that, you know, thousands of people, a couple thousand people will get services, but not 13,000.
Right.
But, you know, he did. He came to our office. He met with families, and a lot of them, you know, were starting to get services from even his meeting there. But there's not enough. You know, there's people who don't are not registered with the system. They don't know that they should be registered. And a lot of times the mom or dad are passed away, and then we'll find out that somebody needs services.
Yeah. And also, then it's a crisis.
It's a crisis. Right. So we worry about the older families and the aging families because Pennsylvania has such a large aging population. So there are quite a few of them. And then there's the kids coming out of school, the young adults, the 21-year-olds who have a full life ahead of them. Our other children at 21 could go to college. They could learn a trade. They could have a life. Our students at age 21 often fall off the cliff,
right.
And they just sit at home. And we do worry about that because a lot of people with intellectual disabilities and autism lose their skills if they sit at home because they've been in school for so long, they learned so much, and then they sit at home for a couple of years, and it causes all other kinds of difficulties.
Well, I think what's embedded in this story is that everyone has a right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, including the adults that we're talking about. Ronnie, let me go back to you because one of the things that you said in this piece, and it's true, and I think we should all applaud the fact that there are advances in medicine, but I think it has also babies that might not have survived or surviving now, living longer into adulthood, that has created in part what it is we're talking about. But again, there's this disconnect. So we have all this investment into medical advances, but then what happens to someone's life who lives beyond the odds?
That's exactly it. And it actually happens across the board in medicine. I remember speaking with a doctor once who said that kids with cystic fibrosis never used to live very long, and now they're living long enough, you know, to have relationships and become pregnant. Now they're like, how do we manage a high-risk pregnancy of a mother with cystic fibrosis? They never lived long enough to have that problem before. And so from the social services standpoint, you know, kids with Downs didn't live very long, and now they're living much, much longer. But there's also a higher incidence of them getting Alzheimer's early.
Oh.
So now we're dealing with people with Down syndrome who have Alzheimer's. They never lived long enough to get anything like that. So you've really hit the nail there.
Well, let me ask you about Marisol and Jose Ramos. You described them in this series of, frankly, what their life is like.
Yeah, and not to punt it back over to Dee and Maureen, but they have known Marisol and Jose for a long time. And Marisol, I think, works at Vision for Equality. So she, if you maybe want to talk a little bit about Marisol.
This is
you
Dee,
know her
yes.
Best.
Yeah. Audrey.
Yeah. Well, Marisol and Jose are my heroes. They never go without a smile on their face. Their lives are extremely difficult. They have two kids with autism, one with very severe autism. She barely sleeps any night. Their son is, he's around 15 or 16. He's still in the school system, which is good. They have just spent their whole lives. They came to this country because they had these folks and they wanted to be able to give them a life. And you know, it's really hard when you have, especially when you have kids with very severe intellectual disabilities. You really live each day on a prayer, you know, because
waking up each morning hoping things will be okay.
And Marisol has had a lot of medical health problems. The stress of living like this every day, sometimes getting 1 or 2 hours a night of sleep. Having neighbors who complain because of the screaming and yelling maybe in the house of the young person. It's pretty difficult. It's pretty and still Marisol wanted to devote her life not only to helping her own children but to helping other people's children as well, and especially in the Latino community.
I mean, that is a powerful story. This is their life. This is what they live every day.
And she had a stroke as well. Marisol had a stroke at 44, I think.
Right, and she just recently almost lost her sight from her diabetic condition. So, I mean, she's really had a heart, and she never, there's never a day that she doesn't smile and come in fully prepared to do a job.
So taking the Ramos family, in a perfect world, and perhaps I can put this to you, Maureen, in a perfect world, how could they be helped?
Well, you know, I think because of your intervention, Ronnie, they have received some waiver services for their daughter in home. But, you know, we know it's not always sufficient, you know, and I think there are some other issues that, you know, are personal that, you know, we're not going to say right now, but they're probably going to need more help in the future. Their son does not have a waiver, although he is in school, and, you know, I don't know what kind of support he has. But, you know, this family is amazing. They will be in crisis, and when they need more support, hopefully the state will be and the city will be there to help them. That's the problem, too. Sometimes, you know, you're doing okay, then you get sick or something happens, and then you just are in crisis because it's not a one-person job. Marisol and Jose have each other. My husband, Tom, and I support Colleen. You can't do this alone. I envy, and I just don't know how the families, the single parents in this system do it. We have many of them. And yesterday we were at a meeting with the Providers Association talking about the lack of respite care that is in
this
system.
That's where someone comes in and gives the family a break, right?
Comes in. Years ago, we had two agencies, at least that I know of in the city, that provided out-of-home respite. They had respite homes where you could go to on the weekends. That is not available anymore because of the rate changes that were provided a few years ago. And they reduced the rates that the providers, you know, close these respite homes. Our inner city families and our families who are single, our families who are in crisis with husbands or wives that are sick, need that kind of support, out-of-home respite. You can do in-home respite when, you know, there's not as much of a crisis, you know, just for relief. We have families that used that respite in the past just so that mom could sleep. And the son or daughter could go away for a week or so, and they could both have a little break. You know, we don't have that any longer. And I think that's one thing we don't talk enough about.
Let me read a comment from one of our listeners. Why are providers allowed to not disclose investigation reports to family members? No transparency. We were kept in the dark. And I think he was talking about Blossom, but I might be conflating some of the calls we got in. But that's something that you wrote about, Ronnie.
Harold Brubaker, who is a colleague of mine at the Inquirer, has written a lot about Blossom, and he's doing really great reporting. And I think there it had to trickle out that there were abuses there. And I think even still, families still aren't being told what exactly happened and what steps are being taken. And I don't know why that is. And that's actually something that's going to be part of a follow-up that I'll be doing over the next months. Maybe you know something.
They are supposed to share with a family a summary of the results. I can tell you we have a long history of Vision being very opposed to providers doing their own investigations. We feel
you
like
need outsiders.
We don't need the fox watching the hen house. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but it's very difficult to usually come up with something that is totally, you know, unbiased when you're doing it. After all, they have liability issues. They have, you know, unions to deal with. So there's many things that impact on them. And families have been fighting for years to ask them to have an independent system. Now, we did finally, I think partially because of Vision for Equality, get what they talk about, adult protective services. It took us 15 years on the Hill to get an adult protective services legislation, and it's now working. And but they only take very serious things. You know, it's almost you would have to be someone would have to almost have death before they get called in. Wow. And we're not happy with the adult protective system because it got watered down. Everything you get, by the time everybody gets their hands on it, it gets watered down. So
let me quote something again from your story, Ronnie. A 2012 report from Disability and Abuse Project, 70% of these adults we're talking about with intellectual and developmental disabilities had been abused. Did I read that right?
You did. Yeah.
70%.
70%. Now, the abuse could have ranged from being, you know, yelled at and sort of, you know, emotionally abused to also sexual assault. But yeah, 70%.
So this is a vulnerable population,
terribly
obviously.
Vulnerable. And also, they're also not believed. If they're unable to communicate well or at all, people will say, well, you know them. They're just not aware of what's going on, and they conflate things, and they're not with it. And so they're particularly vulnerable, very much so.
For that very reason. Yeah. Let me get, looks like Angela from Pottstown to join us on Radio Times. Angela, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, and
hi there.
Good morning. Yes, I was calling and just to hop on exactly what DiCaccia was saying, that the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services does not even enforce the policies that are already in place, the federal regulations and the state laws. Those are our 55 PA codes. And families are very vulnerable to the supports coordinators and the providers that are coming into the homes to take care of the disabled, provide that monthly monitoring, and they're not being held accountable. And I've had conversations with many people that are in a position to speak up for families, families that have been criminalized by the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services for paperwork errors. And here we have Blossom and other provider agencies that are not even given a slap on the hand. While their license has been revoked, they're not being brought to court as families were and prosecuted for Medicaid fraud.
Well, Angela, you put a lot on the table, but you also mentioned DHS. And if I can put this to you, Maureen, so once someone ages out and they fall off the cliff at age 21, what agency is responsible for services? I mean, if for a family, who do they turn to? Is it DHS?
After they're 21?
Yes.
No, they would go to, you know, Department of Developmental Programs. They would register with their support coordination agency in Philadelphia or the state, and each area of the state, and they would put them on a waiting list. So it would be under Department of Human Services, certainly, but then Office of Developmental Programs is under the Department of Human Services.
Let me say that I do think that there has been a major breakdown. Sports coordinator is supposed to follow the person, and when they follow the person, they should be responsible to report any incidents that happen, as well as the agency. Although the agency does the investigation, which is something families don't really approve of, there is a sports coordinator involved. And in this Blossom situation, let me tell you, a lot of sports coordinators, I give them credit, they came forward and they spoke out about what they felt was a terrible situation happening to those folks. And Angela's right. You know, some of these folks should be held accountable for what they do. They should be held accountable because they have taken money. People haven't had food on the table, haven't gotten to doctors, haven't gotten their medicine, and have been poorly treated, and sometimes no one even in the house with them, left in the house alone. So that money should be sent back. Fraud needs to be – and I think CMS needs to get involved in some of this.
And I'm Marty Moscowen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Renee, let me go back. Let's talk about some of these home care aides. One gentleman that you profile, Nicholas Smith, taking care of this young man, Will Ridley. I mean, you know, who wouldn't want Nicholas Smith taking care of someone in your family? He seems like a man of love and care and a great deal of attention. On the other hand, there's a lot of turnover. People are poorly paid. Help us understand the caregiver situation.
Caregivers go by all kinds of names. They're direct support professionals, they're home health aides, they're personal care aides. And I think basically in this country, we just devalue care, the concept of care. And so I think the whole profession is just seen as babysitting. It's not seen as responsible people helping adults try to have the fullest lives that they can. The wages for them average nationwide, anywhere I'd say between $10, maybe even $9.50 an hour to maybe $13 an hour. And if you're dealing with someone who's highly functional, look, even that I don't think is enough. But the job itself could be really physically demanding. If you've got someone who is in a wheelchair, they can't toilet themselves, they can't eat, so it's very physically demanding. A lot of these, so many of them get so close to these people, so it's really emotionally taxing. They really love their clients, they become part of the families, but they may be paid a low hourly wage, they may not get any benefits, there's no paid time off. And someone like Nick Smith, who I wrote about, he works 60 hours a week to try to make enough because I think he's 42, I think I said, and he has a teenage daughter. All he does is work.
Yeah.
And he had had kind of a corporate job, and he said it just didn't feed his soul. He got into doing supports work. It's too long of a story about how he did it, but he just fell in love with it. And so we don't have enough people like Nick. And then also, because of the wages and everything else, the churn is so terrible. And then they also can't really attract people who are very qualified, retain them. And then when you have a churn, there's a constant learning curve with patients. You create a difficult situation, and it's a mess.
In fact, Maureen, you're quoted in this series saying this is devalued people caring for devalued people.
Right. And really, we have wonderful, wonderful direct support professionals out there.
No question.
And I think we need to thank them for all the work they do. And I think that they deserve a living wage. Hey, if they worked in an institution, they make $25 or $30 an hour.
With benefits.
With benefits. So we're talking about people who don't even make half that much. So, you know, I think I really want to applaud them because I think that I don't want them to feel that this is about them. There are some people who have difficulties, and we're addressing them. But we need these people every day to help us support our sons and daughters. And a lot of them are wonderful, and I think we need, you know, some agencies provide really wonderful training, others don't. And I think we need cross-system training and support. A lot of our folks now are going to be going out into the community doing more stuff. We're going to see more people out because the workshops are slowly closing and downsizing.
I'm going to pick up on that, yeah.
So, but out in the community, you really do need more seasoned people and people who are attuned to what it's in the person's plan and who can support the person in the way that that person needs, and everyone's individual.
Well, let's take a very short break. And I'm just, you know, I do remember from the 70s that when deinstitutionalization was the plan forward, the idea was, well, the money will follow these people into the community and then it will pay for the services. But clearly that has not happened. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just recap here. We are talking about Ronnie Polonesky's series in the Philadelphia Daily News, Philadelphia Inquirer this week, called Falling Off the Cliff. And it's about the difficulties that adults with intellectual disabilities and their aging parents face as they deal with things like long waiting lists for services, poorly trained and sometimes poorly paid staff, money problems, a confusing bureaucracy. And Ronnie is a Metro columnist at the Philadelphia Daily News, won the Eugene C. Pullman Journalism Fellowship for her coverage of this story. Also with us, Audrey Cochia, Dee Cochia, and Maureen Devaney. They are co-founders and co-executive directors of Vision for Equality Incorporated. And you can join our conversation. That phone number again is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Kathy. We raised our daughter at home and had great family church support. We worried who could care for her like us. So when she died almost 3 years ago at the age of 29, in some sense, we were relieved, as with our faith, we knew that she was well and in God's hand waiting for us to join her. You touched on this earlier, which is, and these are questions parents have to deal with. But if you have a child with disabilities, it's an even more critical question, Maureen, about how do I plan for their future? How do I know when I'm not here that that plan that I put in place is going to be carried out to my satisfaction?
It's a difficult situation that we all become as parents of children and adults with disabilities especially. I was with someone last night and she said, I just hope my son can go before I go so that I know he's in God's hands and okay, that I can die in peace. And we hear this all the time from families, that we don't say that about our other children, but our kids with disabilities, you know, we know that while we're here, we can oversee their care. It is difficult to plan because a lot of the times, you know, daughter like mine is kind of difficult to, you know, you need 24-hour care. So, you know, you really don't want to hand that over to the siblings. You know, you really want someone to step in. But you don't know who that is going to be. And right. Unless you make the decision that they leave home, you know, early and, you know, before you go. And that's very hard for some of us to do.
So you could go to, I guess, a group home. You could go to independent living situation or at least an apartment with a caretaker or an institution, right?
Right.
Those are the...
Yeah, they're the options. There's not, you know, a whole lot of options. I mean, you know, a lot of the families we know, their sons and daughters are still home and they're getting up to close to 50 yeah. years old. And, you know, we're starting to worry. And we are, you know, hopefully wanting to do some training around this. We have had training in the past. We had a Pennsylvania Training Partnership for People with Disabilities and Families. And we did a lot of training on how people can enter the system, what can happen, you know. And now we have the Pennsylvania Family Network. It's a statewide training that we're trying to, you know, get to families. And we want to do an aging piece because we realize that families don't plan.
They don't plan because... It's hard to plan. I mean, it's hard plans to plan. For their
right.
demise. I mean,
yeah, and,
let's be
you
honest.
Know, you do need a will, and you do need a special attorney. You can't just go to any attorney for your will because, you know, there are special needs attorneys out there that really need to help us, you know, set all these plans in place. But it's expensive, and a lot sure. of families can't afford it, especially our city families.
Dee, you began the hour talking about your daughter, but also. Hoping, I guess, believing that living in this community, there are people watching out for her.
I do. And I hope that's going to remain the way it is and that if we're not here anymore, that she can maybe continue to live in our home, live in that neighborhood where people know her. Her sister lives around the corner. She recently lost her husband, but I know she would look after my daughter. And then I have a few grandsons. They're all young men. And one of them is in the field with us. And but you worry, you
sure.
know. And I have to tell you, there's many mornings, and this sounds awful to say, but and like Maureen said, you wouldn't say this ever about another child you had. But there's many mornings when I'm bathing, on my knees on the floor bathing her, that I ask God to make sure she leaves this world before me.
Just because of the worry about her future
absolutely,
without you.
Absolutely, right. And, you know, maybe that's – I know it's selfish. I do know that. And I know it's not realistic, but I think it's the only thing that can give you some comfort that you think that hopefully – maybe you'll live to be 100 and they'll live to be – you know, but they'll go before you do. And so, you know, I kind of press God about that
sure.
quite a bit.
It's totally understandable. Let me see what looks like Margaret has to say. Margaret, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, I had to put my son into a disabled home when I was 80 because he came home when he was 19 with a brain tumor and I couldn't find any help in Chester County.
Wow.
No one told me how to find any help. They didn't tell me. Mm-hmm. Department of Aging was also Department of Aging and Disability. And I think knowing that you can find help, these people are wonderful because there's no resource for you if you don't know where to look.
Well, I really appreciate you calling in, and I think, Margaret, you really underscore what we've been talking about here, which is just you have to be like our two guests here just to know the system inside out to make it work for you. So I appreciate you calling in. Anyone want to add anything to
that? Yeah, well, we, for a while,
Margaret
maybe for
said,
about five or six.
Dee.
Yeah, excuse me.
No,
yeah,
sorry.
For maybe about 10 years, we were doing incredible work along with Temple University and across the entire state, Vision for Equality in Temple, along with Achieva. There were five organizations that came together. We created curriculum, and we hit every corner of the state getting to families, and there was such a thirst out there. That money was eventually taken away from us. And I can't tell you how many times we get calls from families begging us to do it again. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important because if you don't know how to navigate the system, no matter what your issue is, whether it's a cancer or it's, you know, someone with a brain tumor or whatever, you really need all the help you can get. Not that you can't learn to do it for yourself, but right. you need someone to show you how to do that and to be able to get the services you need.
Ronnie, let me ask you about State Representative Stephen Kinsey and Norman Moore.
Oh,
in certain ways, you end the series with their story.
Yeah, they're wonderful. So State Rep Stephen Kinsey is based out of, I think it's West Mount Airy. He had been in the supports coordination field before he ran for office. He had worked later in the man who preceded him in the office. But he worked for an organization called Horizon House, and they wanted him to begin a program called Life Sharing. Life Sharing is – it's the concept is similar probably to like foster care, but it's for adults. And, you know, you get a stipend, but believe me, people don't do it for the stipend because you're basically taking someone in and literally making them part of your family, yeah. Like holidays, birthdays, everything. So you should have Steve on one day, Steve and Norman. They're
Norman,
hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So Steve was speaking with Norman, and Norman is now 63, but this was 18 years ago. And he had born, when he was born, he had a intellectual disability. He was also terribly abused as a child, and he was in and out of foster care, and his life was just a mess. I think he was living on his own at 16, and he was homeless, and then he lived in boarding homes where people stole things from him. He did get into a group home, but he had some issues with the other people. So they asked him, would you like to do life sharing, live with a family? And by then he sort of knew Steve, and he said, well, I want to live with Steve. And I don't think Steve had ever considered this. And then he started thinking about it, and he said, so they sort of had this get-to-know-your-you-know each other thing where he came over a few times for dinner, and Steve was a single dad. He's got four daughters. And eventually he said, all right, you're going to live here. And it's been 18 years.
Wow.
And
that's a great story.
It's the relationship's beautiful, and he's very much a part of that family. He goes to Steve's mother's house for dinner. He's there for all the holidays. It's a beautiful story, and it's not without its challenges, which is what I like. There's nothing sentimental about any of this. This is just nothing but sort of good, important love. You know, someone once told me, you know, the best things you do are often the hardest things you do, and it's a really wonderful arrangement he has.
It was really moving and touching as I read that in your series. Let me read a comment from someone who wants to remain anonymous. I'm a regulator for group and neighborhood homes for the state of Delaware. Absolutely agree with the guest. Society is still not providing nearly enough support for this population. Respite care is extremely difficult. Enrollment into a skilled nursing home is nothing short of impossible. Sadly, my division puts the quality assurance and regulatory oversight on the back burner. I'd love to pick the speaker's brain when there is time. Does this surprise you, Maureen?
No, it doesn't surprise me. You know, I think everybody struggles with how to make, you know, quality care for people and how to provide enough services. Not everybody. We have good providers that really struggle with how to make this work. You know, with minimum wage and things like that. So, you know, I think the whole system really needs to come together and figure out how not to have another situation like Blossom.
Yeah.
How to create a system where you can report things and people will listen and people will make a decision on, you know, not wait 6 months that there was a problem 6 months ago and we're still finding out now. Go in right when there's an issue, solve it, you know, and move on. Be transparent with families. Make sure to talk to them in your agencies. They need to hear from you. They need to hear that you're supporting them. There's so much of a crisis. And I think our population is very quiet. Our families don't speak up. They are
silent. Is it because they're overwhelmed?
No. I think they want to do the job. They want to take care of their children. They don't want to go public with all this information. They want to keep their family life private, and they want to be. And there are strong men and women out there taking care of these people every day, family members, and they want to continue to do that to the best of their ability. And they don't always want to depend on the system, but when they need the system, it should be there. And you know, I worry about what's happening, going to happen in Washington with Medicaid, because this will really cut most of what we have today.
Yeah, I saw that little reference. Ron, you want to say something, then we'll get Mary to join us.
Thanks. One other thing, too. I've talked to families who say they're afraid to speak up because of retaliation.
Yes.
I got an email from someone who said after waiting a full year for certain kinds of services, she made a formal complaint. And 2 days later, something retaliatory happened. They said, oh, the aide who you're supposed to have for the next 2 weeks, she can't do it. And now this family is without any help for 2 weeks, and she sees cause and effect. So people are really afraid. They would rather do with some care that might be substandard than have nothing.
Mm-hmm. Let me see what Mary from Bucks County has to say. Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I am very concerned, and I'm so happy that you had the articles in the paper. I have a special needs niece who lives outside of Harrisburg. She's 36 and has worked for a major food chain for many years, over 10 years. And when I met with her recently, she was very concerned that they have reduced her hours. And now she's going to have trouble paying her bills.
Oh.
I'm very proud of her. She lives like in a group home situation. She goes to work faithfully. She does carts and bags. But that is all that she's capable of doing. And it was very sad for me to see. I'd like to know why they are reducing the hours of our special needs adults who are baggers and cart people.
Sure, Mary.
And this is a...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can answer that specific question about why this particular supermarket cut her hours, but I think it underscores another piece of what this whole series is about, which is having to do with the fact that we're talking about people with disabilities who do have jobs, who work in the community or sheltered workshops. Let me just quickly remind our listeners that you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. As she was talking, I'm thinking about it. My supermarket, there are a couple of guys there who load the packages in your car if you want, or they clean up, or they bag groceries, and even movie theaters. I mean, it seems like more and more we are seeing people with disabilities working amongst us, but there are also these sheltered workshops. I'm not sure who I should pass this to. How about for you, Dee? Help us understand the role of these workshops and their future.
Yeah, frankly, my daughter was in a workshop for a long time, but she spent more time in the supervisor's office than she did on the floor doing a job. So it was clear to me that's not what she wanted for her life. So that's why we did eventually move her somewhere else where we thought she could get more community opportunity. And yet when you talk to some of the people who work in the workshops, because we know a lot of the folks in the system, they'll tell you, well, these are where my friends are, and I make a couple dollars, things like that. And I know that we have, hopefully, an opportunity. The governor is working very hard to start employment for people with intellectual disability and autism, and I hope we're going to see far more, you know, businesses be willing to try. These folks are super. You know, you just need to give them a chance, you know. And there'll probably be less work than other people that you have on your other staff. But in any case, I think it's important for us to acknowledge that there are some people who may not want to do it. And if we talk about real choice, we have to think about that. And also some families who are very worried about vulnerable people being
sure.
out in the community.
Sure.
We may not agree. I mean, there's always, I'm sure in every field, there's always differences of opinion and how to approach something. So, and I think we have to respect and hear people. And we may disagree, and perhaps we're right, maybe they're wrong, and maybe we're both right. But I think it's important for people to get a chance to be out in the world.
Sure. I regret to say that we are almost out of time. But Ronnie, what's been the response to this series, and where do you go from here?
The response has been just terrific. I've heard from so many families, and I can't wait to dig into telling more stories and to go a little bit deeper in each of the sections that I did in the piece. And just a little shout out, if people want to look at it, it's designated. Just go to philly.com/IDD, and you can IDD. Read the series there. And then as we begin to build on it, I think we'll be adding more stories in there. A few things. Senator Bob Casey has an op-ed in today's online, philly.com. It'll be in the Sunday Inquirer. And he talks about what is sort of afoot legislatively. There's a bill that would help people get more money for waivers, et cetera. Also at the end of part one, State Rep Tom Mert has four bills that could really use some support. If you go to there, please read that and make a call.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ronnie Polonesky, again, thanks for coming in, and
thank
congratulations
you.
On the series. Audrey Cochia, Maureen Devaney, thank you for coming in
thank
as
you.
Well. And they are co-founders and co-executive directors of Vision for Equality Incorporated. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.